This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us on our Main Street across our state of North Dakota this time of day. And of course, it's winter in North Dakota and everywhere across the country. Pretty much an epic winter in some places, including our place. But imagine, 400 years ago, when the pilgrims were landing at Plymouth Rock in late fall of 1620, and the winter they had to go through. That was epic as well. We're going to talk a bit about that and the legal structure that came out of those intrepid explorers to North America many, many years ago with Julia Ernst. She is an associate professor of law, teaching constitutional law, among other things, at the UND School of Law. She joins us from a studio in Grand Forks. Thanks for being with us, Julia.
Thank you very much for having us.
And with you, your mother from Michigan, Janet Ernst, because there's a very interesting wrinkle to this story we're about to get into. Janet, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the reason we're talking to you, Julia, is because we came across a news release that said you're going to be talking tomorrow about the Mayflower Compact and the U.S. Constitution that'll be late in the afternoon on Wednesday at the UND Memorial Union Lecture Bowl. It's free and open to the public. The lecture is at 4:30. There's a reception at 4 o'clock, and we'll mention that again. But so this is an important anniversary coming up in 2020. That's the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower Compact, right?
Absolutely. And there are going to be celebrations across the country. So I would encourage everyone to watch for those celebrations. There hopefully will be a lot of lectures and information and other events. And there are particularly going to be several events in Plymouth and around Plymouth. Mom, would you like to say a few words about what's going to be happening?
Every 3 years, the General Society meets in Plymouth, Massachusetts. There's an annual meeting every year, but they go to various states throughout the United States for the other two. And there are 60-plus members normally, I believe, at the Plymouth meeting. But this coming year, the 400th anniversary, they expect so many people that Plymouth, Massachusetts is not going to be able to handle it. So they've expanded it to Provincetown and Boston also. There will be events in all three, and it's going to be very exciting.
And, of course, we should mention that Janet is with us because she's very proud of her daughter and wants to see her speak tomorrow, but also because Janet has an ancestor named John Billington, who was among those people who were the pilgrims who landed at Plymouth Rock.
That's right. This is one of the fun stories that had been handed down to us when we were growing up as children. And Mom would tell us about this and some of our other relatives, that John Billington came over on the Mayflower. So we heard about this every Thanksgiving. But also, not only did he come over on the Mayflower, he was the first person to be hanged in the colony. And so that was something that my grandmother was quite mortified about. So she didn't like it when we raised that, but we kids thought it was absolutely fantastic.
And my husband loved to tease, so he kidded her about it all the time until she finally just had to laugh every time he brought it up.
And the law and a little history runs in the family because your late husband, J. Richard Ernst, was a retired Michigan Circuit Court judge.
Correct. We've been on all sides of the law. Well, not personally, but we have the history of the...
Well, let's a little bit more about John Billington, because we usually think of the Mayflower as having these religious dissidents going across a stormy North Atlantic and landing in a forbidding area at a tough time of the year. But religious dissidents were only part of the people who were on that first boat. There were lots of what they called strangers, right? And that was John Billington as well.
That's right.
John Billington and his wife and two boys. There were four of my ancestors actually that came over.
That's right. So. And with the so-called strangers, that was the term that the religious group who had broken off from the Church of England, they were known as the Separatists from breaking away from the Church of England, and they called themselves the Saints. And so when we think of the Pilgrims, we think of all of those who came over on the Mayflower, but they actually, the religious group who were the dissenters, called themselves the Saints, and they called these others the strangers.
the people who could do stuff, though.
That's right. Exactly right. They were merchants. They were craftsmen. They were indentured servants. Right. They had a lot of skills that were necessary for the survival of the colony.
Now, before we start talking about the Mayflower Compact, we should mention that John Billington was rather well known as a kind of a troublemaker, wasn't he, Janet?
I guess he had his own way of thinking, and yeah. Right, he was more independent, but he was also very necessary for his hunting skills, building skills, and all of those things that helped them get through the first winter. All four of the Billingtons survived, and they lost half of the passengers of the Mayflower were lost the first year. It was such a hard winter.
Yeah.
They were not prepared.
And they were dying on the voyage across as well.
That's right.
There was a mutiny on the Mayflower, and so I suspect that some of that dissent and, you know, discomfort with some people probably transferred to the colony itself.
Well, it's interesting because with respect to the voyage on the Mayflower, they actually were supposed to land in what was then called Northern Virginia. They had a patent from the king or a charter from the king to establish a colony, a royal colony, in what they called Northern Virginia. It was actually the territory of Virginia went all the way up to the Hudson Bay. So they actually were supposed to be landing at the Hudson Bay, known at the time as Northern Virginia. However, they got driven off course, and when they tried to sail down the coast to land where they were supposed to be heading, the because of the fall weather and the winter storms that were coming and the rocky shoals, they decided it was too dangerous, and so they turned around and went back up to the Cape Cod region. Well, because of that, some of the so-called strangers on the ship, those who were brought over for their skills, they said, well, once we land, you actually do not have the authority to govern us because we are landing in a territory that you don't have a legal claim to. And so we can go off on our own and not worry about the colonists. But the religious passengers and the leaders knew that for the survival of the colony, for the survival of all of the settlers, they would have to work together. And this is where no one was allowed to leave the ship for the permanent plantation. Of course, they had folks that had gone off exploring a bit, but they weren't allowed to disembark as a whole until they had agreed upon this compact, the Mayflower Compact, which was an agreement for their governance and that they would all agree to obey the leaders. And that's how the original Mayflower Compact came about.
So they create this Mayflower Compact, which I note John Billington signed as well.
Yes.
What was the essence of the compact, Julia?
The essence of the compact, it is very short, but the primary essence of the compact, and I'll read a short excerpt from it. It says that they hereby covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid, and by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinance, acts, and constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. So that was the primary text of the covenant. Basically, it's a short framework, a short agreement to establish a structure of government. It isn't the laws themselves. It doesn't establish the structure of the government itself. But it is an agreement, a social contract, so to speak, that they would agree to combine together and work together and obey the governance that they established together. And that was the first such agreement that occurred in the New World. And of course, as you know, in Europe and in England, but in Europe as a whole, monarchy was still the common form of governance. And so this was a fairly radical new approach to have this governance that they all agreed to and all agreed to contribute to and obey.
Well, I also noted that it starts with the loyal subject of our dread sovereign lord, King James. Does dread mean something different in 1620?
Well, that can, if you look at some of the religious terms as well, when we speak about, dread God the Father, that type of thing, it's more a term of respect, I think, for someone important, for a monarch, for the king, for a deity, etc. So not necessarily that they're dreading him, but that they're showing deference and showing loyalty to the king. Because actually, even though they were fleeing the persecution that they had faced because they were separatists away from the Church of England, they still pledged their fealty and their loyalty to the monarch and to the king, and were very, very proud to be English and proud of their English citizenship and English heritage.
And of course, all that religion was mixed up in there. King James was the son of the Queen of Scotland, who was beheaded by indirect order of Queen Elizabeth, who was the head of the Church of England. The Queen of Scotland was Catholic.
So all
this stuff is a mess.
Very much intertwined.
What went into the creation of the compact? Who wrote it? Did William Brewster write it?
There's not much that has been written at all upon about the compact itself. The original compact was lost, so we don't have the original document. The passage that I just read to you was written by William Bradford, who was one of the original governors of the colony, and it's in a book that he wrote. It was his notes, but was later published as a book, and it's called Of Plymouth Plantation, 1620 through 1647. So that is the transcription of what would have been the original document. There's another compilation of notes called Mort's Relations, a journal of the pilgrims at Plymouth. And these are some of the only original documentation that they have, but the original compact itself has been lost.
How was it enforced?
So they elected a governor then, and like I said, William Bradford was one of the original governors. Initially there was a small council. The elders of the plantation, and those who had been esteemed members within the colony, particularly those who were the religious members within the saints, the group of saints. And they were the ones who originally ran the government. Now, interestingly, as we think about our government today, we have the separation of powers, which is a very, very important component of our U.S. Constitution as it is today. So we think of the executive branch being separate from the legislative branch and being separate from the judicial branch. However, back in the original colonies, and this is, of course, not only Plymouth, but Massachusetts Bay Plantation colony and the other colonies, a lot of those functions were overlapping. So the same people who would create the laws would be the same people who would enforce the laws and would be the same people before whom trials were heard. So we didn't have that concept of the separation of powers until a bit later.
So they were very powerful people then.
Absolutely.
Did they serve until there was an effort to remove them, or?
Well, actually, there was a fairly regular transition of power, and because of course each of the people who were governing were also having to do their own work and labor in the plantation, and so interestingly, the foundation of democracy within the United States started with a transition of power and a very peaceful and cordial transition from one governor to the next. So that helped establish that that tradition of transition of power as well.
Well, you referred to this these people as being elected. Who elected them? Were men and women voting?
Now, that's a great question. So only 41 of the 50 male adult males who came over on the Mayflower actually signed the compact. And so you can see the indentured servants were not among those who signed the compact. So there were distinctions that were made at the time as well. Only adult men signed the compact. So women were not permitted to, and according to the custom and the traditions at the time, they were not permitted to form a part of the governance of the colony. So it was the adult male. And the adult males who were the free adult males. But if you fast forward to the foundation of the United States as we know it today with the U.S. Constitution, at the time the Constitution was adopted, only 6% of the population were allowed to vote.
Yes.
So the landed, the propertied free males And actually 20% of the population at the time were enslaved at the time of the adoption of the U.S. Constitution, which we think of the Revolutionary War as being fought for freedoms and liberty. And of course, only 6% having the right to vote. We've seen a lot of changes in our governance structure since that time. But again, the seeds of democracy were planted, and not only with the U.S. Constitution, but way back to the establishment of the Mayflower Compact and Plymouth Plantation governance.
And for our listeners, you mentioned indentured servants. That mm-hmm. was something of the time. Mm-hmm. And these people were not, I guess, slaves literally, but not far from it.
Right.
There were also many young children that came over as indentured slaves, young children.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As indentured servants as well. Mm-hmm. And they actually had brought over orphans as well as part of the strangers, the group of strangers, who they felt would be able to help work on the colony. So children were expected to work, including as indentured servants as well.
Now, of course, the North Atlantic, had been crossed before many mm-hmm. times. There mm-hmm. were fishermen and other expeditions that had been over to North America, but still, mm-hmm. this was a dangerous voyage.
Oh, absolutely. And as you say, people had crossed over before, and in fact, although we think of Plymouth Plantation as being one of the first, it actually wasn't the first. The first actual settlement was in Jamestown in 1607, and they actually had the first House of Burgesses meeting in 1619, which was a year before the Pilgrims came over on the Mayflower. But it wasn't that type of a democratic system that was established kind of organically as it was through the Mayflower Compact. There were other colonies that were lost
right,
as well. The
Jamestown,
lost colony of Roanoke.
Yes.
Jamestown, the people of Jamestown had simply disappeared
right.
when the ship came back
mm-hmm.
there following.
Right,
before,
so they weren't
yes.
they weren't long established settlements,
they
but there had been
know,
attempts made.
They do not know much about what happened to them.
Right.
This was very much a matter of news and interest in England. Shakespeare wrote about it mm-hmm. in his plays. Julia Ernst is going to be giving a faculty lecture, The Mayflower Compact in the U.S. Constitution, Wednesday at 4:30 at the UND Memorial Union Lecture Bowl. It is free and open to the public. And again, we're talking about this seminal document for governance in the United States by those people who got off the Mayflower 400 years ago next year, and how that may have evolved into what we now, look at very reverently as the United States Constitution, which is itself an evolving document. Julia, how did a bunch of independent colonies, very much different from each other in some ways, become the United States?
Yes, that's interesting. And the loyalty of each person within each of the colonies was really to their particular colony, their individual colony. So I am a Virginian, or I am a Rhode Islander, not necessarily I am from the United States. They really thought of each other, of their own colonies, as independent states or independent nations. However, with the development of the colonies and the colonial democracies, again, democracy with a small d, because not everyone was voting or allowed to vote, but they were based on self-governance and self-rule initially, in part because the voyage back and forth across the Atlantic was very dangerous. It didn't happen very frequently, so it was very difficult for the king at first to be able to exert any control over the colonies. And so they really grew up under this democratic self-rule. However, when fast forward quite a few decades and a century, then King George, as we know, tried to clamp down more on the colonies and wanted the balance of trade to be more in the favor of England rather than the colonies, and tried to assert a lot more royal rule over the colonies and take away some of that independence and democracy that they had grown up under. And of course, the colonists rebelled at that. They didn't want to give up their democracy and their freedoms and be told what to do by this king who was clamping down on them more severely. And so we have the iconic instance of the Boston Tea Party, for example, in 1773, where the colonists rebelled against the tea tax that King George was attempting to impose. and the Stamp Acts. And this led to each of the colonies saying, we need to band together and throw off this tyrannical king, and therefore come together and form an army initially. The Continental Congress was really there to oversee the direction of the Revolutionary War. And then after they won the war, the Continental Congress thought, okay, well, we need a way to govern ourselves, and initially came up with the Articles of Confederation that you had mentioned previously.
Well, let's get back to Janet, because Janet, they have a Mayflower Compact. They've got this sort of legal process now, and they kept records. And John Billington keeps showing up. In 1621, John Billington Sr., challenged Miles Standish's orders for contempt of the captain's lawful command with several speeches. So he was outspoken, I take it.
Well, I guess he was very outspoken, and I guess there were even occasions where Eleanor, his wife, became quite outspoken too. So that's another story.
Well, 6 years after John Billington was tried and hanged, she was sentenced to sit in the stocks and whipped for slandering John Doan. So it was another man of
history. That's right. But I do have to say, we have to remember who wrote these records. They were Brewster and Bradford, who did not like John Billington. Well, although he lived right across from each of them, right across and kitty corner for them. Their homes, they got plots by a drawing, and it just so happened that he was right on one of the main corners, and they were too.
Well, they shared a neighborhood.
they all shared a very small neighborhood.
Yes, and there's one more entry here, that in 1624, John Billington was implicated for a revolt against the rule of the Plymouth Church. So the church was an important part of this governance thing too, I take it.
Oh, absolutely. The church, again, we don't have the separation of church and state back in that time that we would have thought about today. And even though the separatists from the Church of England were fleeing England so that they could practice their own religion, so they were fleeing religious persecution, that's not to say that they were completely tolerant either. In terms of religion, so those who came to the colony were expected to, I at least adhere to a certain extent to the religious order that the colonists then established. Now, within Plymouth Colony, they were a bit more tolerant, perhaps, than we might think of as the Puritans, for example, in Massachusetts. And of course, we remember the Salem witch trials and instances where you were required to go to church, otherwise you would have a fine, that type of thing. And they were actually a bit more tolerant in Plymouth Colony than in other, perhaps other times and other places. But there was still not the religious tolerance and religious freedom that we would think of today.
And just finally here, we've been mentioning this, but in 1630, John Billington was tried and hanged for the murder of another colonist.
Mm-hmm. Mom, do you want to talk about that story?
Well, there are several different stories, and there's not much written, but by this time, they had been given property outside. They had divided properties outside of the little village that they had established. And it was given according to the number of people in the households, even if it was children. They were given acres by that. And John Billington had property down by the waters, and there was a young man that came over on one of the later boats, and he kept stealing from John Billington's traps. And John Billington didn't like that, and he had told him that he was not to be on his property, and it continued. I have been told, or I have read, that he actually was trying to scare the young man, but he did not just scare him. He shot him.
Well, he got the distinction of being the first man hanged by Plymouth Colony. He was about 40 years old when that happened. Julia Ernst will be delivering the faculty lecture, The Mayflower Compact and the U.S. Constitution, tomorrow at 4:30 at the UND's Memorial Union Lecture Bowl. There's a reception just before that at 4. Again, it is free and open to the public. And Janet Ernst, her mother, will be there as well. Janet, thank you for joining us today.
It's been great fun. Thank you.
Julia, good fortune to you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next on Main Street, we'll get some news that's making headlines in South Dakota. But first, the news from North Dakota.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A member of the North Dakota Board of Higher Education has some sharp words for UND President Mark Kennedy's decision to keep his chief of staff on board, allowing her to work from a remote location. UND had said Angelique Foster would stay on as chief of staff. Under the arrangement, which would begin in April, she would work from Texas and would receive a $114,000 per year salary and up to $25,000 in travel expenses. Here's board member Dan Traynor.
I reject the notion that a chief of staff position can be properly performed remotely for any extended arrangement. A chief with no staff is no chief of staff.
Traynor told the board he thinks it may have even been against board policy. He said it isn't proper to take this action at this time, especially since faculty and staff have worked for the past couple of years with no raises.
If UND has an extra $55,000 laying around, I prefer that you put it toward hiring some needed faculty at the law school or other places around campus.
Traynor said this action doesn't look good when the legislature is in session. Other board members questioned whether the board should be weighing in on these on-campus decisions. Here's board member Kathy Nesset.
We hire and fire our campus presidents and our CEO, our chancellor, but this is business of their responsibility.
Kennedy now says Foster would work on campus until April, then will stay on for 6 months and commute from Texas until a replacement is found. And the Better Business Bureau of North Dakota and Minnesota says beware of a scam involving phony auto dealer websites. One bogus dealer called Superior Auto Sales, supposedly based in Fargo, bilked customers out of thousands of dollars in the past month. It usually starts with a listing on Craigslist. Superior uses only email or text to communicate with customers, sends an official-looking invoice for 20% of the vehicle costs, requests bank routing info, and asks for the money to be wired. The BBB's Bess Ellenson says these are major warning signs.
If a seller only wants to talk to you through email or text messaging and refuses to talk to you on the phone or comes up with excuses as to why they can't, that's another thing to be aware of. And wiring money is always, always a big red flag.
Ellenson says there is another oddity.
The person who is sending out the invoices is actually using Barack Obama's signature at the bottom of the invoice. You know, the other thing that we can't really figure out is why whoever's behind this is choosing Fargo, choosing Minot, as a location that they're based out of, because chances are they're probably not there. They're probably not even in this country. We really don't know where they are.
Once the money is wired, Superior stops communicating with the customer, who receives nothing. Ellenson says one man in Wisconsin lost $4,500 in the scam. Ellenson says Superior Auto Sales was the name of a real Fargo business, which the scammers used to fool victims. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. When the snow flies and the mercury drops, we spend more time indoors, warm and perhaps unaware of life that goes on outside our walls. Chuck Lura loves nature. He writes about it in his ongoing series, Natural North Dakota, heard on Main Street and at other times on the Prairie Public Network. Today, Chuck talks about a hardy little bird called the red-breasted nuthatch.
We've had a red-breasted nuthatch coming to our bird feeders regularly this winter. I've not seen more than one at a time, so I'm guessing it's a loner. At any rate, this bird always provides some good entertainment while it seemingly goes about its mission. I suspect that most people are familiar with the more common white-breasted nuthatch. The red-breasted nuthatch is noticeably smaller, and as the name implies, has a reddish or rusty underside. It also has a prominent black stripe running through the eye. The red-breasted nuthatch, Sitta canadensis, is an occasional visitor to our bird feeders throughout the year. Their permanent residence, as the scientific name indicates, in the coniferous forests across much of Canada, and also the Rocky Mountains here in the United States. They may winter southward, roughly from North Dakota southeastward, in part when food supplies are low. So we're on the edge of their permanent range and winter range. Red-breasted nuthatches are monogamous, and they're cavity nesters. It might surprise you, but other than woodpeckers, red-breasted nuthatches are among a small group of birds that excavate their own cavity. From what I've read, and this might strike a chord, both male and female do the excavating, with the female doing most of the work. The cavity will be 2 to 8 inches deep, between 5 and 15 feet above the ground in a conifer or perhaps an aspen or other deciduous tree with soft wood. And there's an interesting twist to the nest cavity. They line the entrance, both the inside and outside, with pitch. It's thought to help repel predators or perhaps competitors. Red-breasted nuthatches are often heard before they're seen. They have a distinctive call that's often described as a nasal ank. It's similar to the white-breasted nuthatch's soft and nasal what, 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 with a little higher pitch. So if you're outside and hear a nasal ank, 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 be on the lookout for a red-breasted nuthatch. If you're interested, you can hear recordings of their call on the Cornell University's All About Birds website. Most of what I hear is their slow call. So make sure your feeders are well stocked with sunflower seeds and suet, and keep your eyes and ears open for this distinctive occasional winter visitor. You may gain a new friend, or perhaps renew an old acquaintance. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Hey, teachers, no need to brave the cold for great professional development. Join Prairie Public's weekly web chats from the cozy, convenient comfort of your home or classroom. This free series features area educators sharing resources, ideas, tips, and tricks to help other teachers maximize their teaching power. Chats are every Tuesday and Thursday, and continuing education credit is available. Go to prairiepublic.org to learn more.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Kara Hetland, the Director of Radio and News and Information for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Thanks for being with us, Kara.
I am so happy to be here.
Well, last week, the North Dakota legislature passed a, you know, sort of a benchmark of the session. They had crossover, or approximately the midpoint. Where's the South Dakota legislature on its session schedule?
We had our crossover day this week as well. So, yeah, just a few weeks left.
So we're almost in step there. What right. is the issue that's getting more attention than most others at the legislature?
Well, you know, right now our lawmakers are focusing more on social issues, I think, than other issues. So it's right now a lot of social issues permitting concealed carry or not permitting concealed carry, legislation that has to do with LGBTQ and transgender students and whether they can or cannot participate in high school activities, those types of social issues. Abortion right now is being debated and putting more restrictions on forcing a woman to see the ultrasound before they can have an abortion, those types of issues that are out there right now.
So these kinds of things can prompt some pretty emotional debate, can't they?
Some emotional debate. A lot of lawmakers. I mean, when you have a supermajority of one party over the other, most of these issues are decided, right? And so the debate and the testimony doesn't really always seem to have an impact in South Dakota.
Ah. Well, you've got the first female governor for your state, Kristi Noem, is, I think, poised to either sign or not sign the bill that would allow South Dakotans to carry concealed guns without a permit?
She did sign. It was the first bill that she signed. She held a ceremony to sign that piece of legislation, something she said she was very proud to do as a governor and a pro Second Amendment governor, and took the stand that this was a good thing in South Dakota.
Now, you've also got a state Senate bill that's been approved to allow concealed or carry guns on campuses, right? Is that not in play
that
as well?
That has failed. Yeah, nope, that was shot down. I'm sorry, that was a bad pun. That piece of legislation failed in committee. So that one, I mean, that was opposed by colleges and universities, the Board of Regents. That didn't have a whole lot of support because it would take it into, you know, athletic events as well.
Now, as I understand it, too, because I've been online looking at issues that sort of caught my attention that were happening in South Dakota, that there's a possibility of citizenship tests for high school graduation?
that is to take that test. Now, it's been watered down just a little bit, and really you have to be able to pass 10 questions. So it keeps getting watered down. It is heading to the floor this week, I believe, if I remember correctly. So it's still being debated. It has passed one chamber. It's now being considered in the other. But it has been watered down. I think the citizenship test is 180 questions, and they watered that down to having to pass 10.
Well, there seems to be a fair amount of attention at the legislature in deciding what should be taught in schools. There was a proposed bill to ban teaching on gender dysphoria. That failed, I take it?
That has failed as well. Obviously the Education Association lobbying group is really opposed to restrictions on what teachers can and cannot say. And so that is being debated, and there is some support for it in the Capitol, but it is failing at the last minute as well.
Well, I also saw a House science bill that would let South Dakota teachers decide how much skepticism to inject into lessons on topics like climate change and other, I guess, socially controversial mm-hmm. issues.
Mm-hmm. Putting words in teachers' mouths and restricting what they can and cannot say. And I'm not exactly sure that specific bill where that is at today, but it is something that they continue. I mean, they have the South Dakota legislature in years past have tried to put words in teachers' mouths for when it comes to teaching, you know, sex education. And things that they can and cannot say. And in science, this has been there and failed in the past. And I just think they're just trying to continue to test this. And part of me feels, you know, this may head to the U.S. Supreme Court if that's really what they're trying to do with language like this as well. But so far, a lot of these get the debate, may pass one chamber, but then fails in the end. And I'm not really sure where Governor Noem is on this kind of legislation.
Well, there's another piece of legislation that's pretty similar to something that's been mulled about in the North Dakota legislature more than once. I saw a story about a House committee rejecting a bill that adds sexual orientation and gender identity to the list of hate crimes in South Dakota statute.
That failed in committee, that they were not going to put that into statute as a list of hate crimes. That failed. That's not something they want to do.
And yet I've also noticed that according to the U.S. Department of Justice, sexual orientation and gender identity make up more than a quarter of all hate crimes in the United States. So this isn't an issue that is insignificant to those people who find themselves in that circumstance.
Right. And, part of you wonder why you wouldn't stand up and make it a hate crime, right?
Yeah. What about the House voting to shorten absentee voting window in South Dakota? Why is that an issue?
The argument is that, you know, some new maybe there's too much time for absentee voting, and then you vote and then you may regret your vote and you may wish you would have changed your vote. That's the argument going in there, that new information comes out at the last minute and maybe we should change it. And I know it's passed one chamber, but I'm not. I don't know how the other side will vote.
It's almost an argument for the social media getting involved in the vote, you know, the last 48 hours, that kind of thing, which we occasionally are concerned about.
Right. Maybe we can just all vote online. Yeah.
Okay. We've also been talking about industrial hemp in North Dakota. Of mm-hmm. course, the national regulations on that have changed a bit. So what's the status of industrial hemp in your state?
Well, I will tell you that the legislature seems to be pushing forward with this issue, and the governor has said, please slow down, let's not. But fortunately, the legislature, or fortunately, depending on your position, the legislature is pushing forward. So they are starting to set rules and requirements for industrial hemp, even though the governor says, let's not, we're not ready. This is a gateway to legalizing marijuana in South Dakota. But the legislature is kind of going against the governor on this one, and we'll see what she does when push comes to shove. But right now, it is passing through every chamber, and it went to appropriations, and it has passed out of appropriations as well.
Well, hemp and recreational marijuana are two very different things, and South Dakota is an agricultural state, so this is something that could be a money winner for some people.
You know, there's if you read some blogs and some criticism, some editorials, wondering if really this is the issue the governor should fall on her sword over. And she helped write the farm bill when she was in Congress, and this is a part of the new farm bill. So why is she not on board to new opportunities for agriculture in her home state? Those are the questions that are coming out, in the blog world and in editorials, and she hasn't really addressed any of that yet.
Now, North Dakota has passed and now is just about to open its first medical marijuana dispensaries. Is South Dakota still debating that issue?
I haven't even heard that that's on the table.
Okay. So, well, you mentioned that Kristi Noem had been in the House and had, you know, worked on the farm bill that was passed, finally. Where is she on this trade war with China that has lots of farmers, especially soybean farmers, very concerned about their livelihoods?
So Governor Noem is very much a supporter of President Trump and his policies, and has taken the stance that sometimes you have to take one for the team for the greater good. And that's the position that she took when she was in Congress. We'll get through this. It might be a tough year. And so she really isn't addressing it right now as governor.
Well, another issue that's out there is climate change. And, of course, that's highly charged politically in some places as well. I noted that Governor Noem has vetoed a Public Utilities Commission bill to define solar energy facilities in South Dakota law. Why?
I don't know. I don't really know. And I don't know if there are enough votes to override her veto. And I just haven't gotten my head wrapped around that one at all.
Okay. So is
really
this something...
Don't know.
Is alternative energy something that South Dakotans are interested in a big way, or is it just a small issue yet?
You know, South Dakota is behind when it comes to solar, any kind of renewable energy. South Dakota is really behind the ball, and I think you can take it all the way back to Governor Jenklow and wind energy. And he took the position, what's going to happen, what happens when the wind doesn't blow? And he never really embraced it. And so you see, Minnesota taking off with all of these wind turbines and wind farms, and South Dakota's not there. And I just think that there hasn't been the leadership in the governor's office to really embrace and move forward. And so they're just taking the slow and steady pace.
Well, North Dakota has a major wind energy development, and they keep adding on to it, as a matter of fact. I think it employs far more people than are in the traditional energy fields now in the state of North Dakota, and North Dakota is an energy exporter. And when the wind doesn't blow, the sun might shine. I mean, there's solar energy, and then there's natural gas for peak power needs and that kind of thing. It's a changing world in terms of the energy that we are developing for the future, I think.
And it's changing all around us, but not quite here. Yeah.
Okay. All right. What is the sales tax debate that the legislature is coping with now? Maybe you could bring us up to date on what the sales tax is in South Dakota and how it's used and why this would be a matter of discussion.
Well, Well, this is a fun one. So let's talk a little bit about the challenge to collecting sales tax online and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that, yes, we can make online sales tax mandatory. And it was the whole Wayfair Supreme Court change. And so now that we can, now they're trying to decide how much we need and what we're going to do with it. And so there was a piece of legislation passed prior to the Supreme Court decision that said, you know what, if we do win, then maybe we need to automatically adjust. So my question is, so what? So we don't take in too much money, or couldn't we find a use for that money, but they're going to maybe lower, or maybe let the Appropriations Committee lower the sales tax, the amount collected, because why would we take in more than we need? Sorry, that was a snarky comment. But that's really what they're debating is, do we need to continue at the rate that we're at for sales taxes, because now we have a new source. And so some Republicans are positioning themselves for a tax cut if they do lower the sales tax amount collected, because we have this new revenue source. So they're trying to decide what language and how they're going to make position themselves. Can we make this look like a tax cut? Now you have some Democrats who think, well, let's just remove the sales tax on food, and that will help all low-income people, and then everybody who buys their stuff online will still pay the same rate. So I'm not sure where the governor falls on all of this, but there is some movement in having kind of an automatic, if we bring in X amount of dollars, then it's going to decrease by a certain percentage every year until we get back to where we are. That's the thinking.
In North Dakota, that online sales tax revenue has been sort of a question mark in terms of how much it would actually be. And I think they've been encouraged by the amount of money that has been coming in, because people are buying more and more and more online. And so that's probably going to be an upward curve for revenue. In South Dakota, you know, in North Dakota, we're always talking about the budget because we're a commodity state. It's energy, it's ag, and those are the two big deals. In South Dakota, how is your budget looking?
This is a good year in South Dakota, and I think that there's a little excess, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. So this is a good year. This is not a cut the budget kind of year. This is a how do we make everybody happy kind of year.
Okay. So how much longer does the legislature go? You got about half the session left now?
We go until about mid-March. I don't have the exact date in my head, but a couple weeks.
Oh, not much
into
longer
March.
Then.
Yeah, not much longer. And then there's some. Then there's a break. I mean, this is only 40 legislative days. Is what we do.
Oh, so you do an annual legislative session then?
Annual legislative session for 40 days.
We do it every 2 years for about 80, I think, is our number. So
right.
They're pretty similar. It's just that we've got a year in between.
Right. So they hit that mark in the second week of March, and then they take a couple of days off, and then they come back for the last day in case there's any vetoes or anything like that to consider.
Well, that's got to keep you pretty busy, because legislatures can go through hundreds of bills, some of them which are pretty eye-catching, some of which are pretty mundane. But, of course, they all govern how the people will, live until the next session, too. So
right.
Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Happy to be here.
Kara Hetland is the Director of Radio for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home. Creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 26th. For 9 months in 1915, Americans engaged in a self-congratulatory celebration. The Panama Pacific International Exposition commemorated the completion of the Panama Canal, which had opened on August 15th the previous year. San Francisco hosted the gathering, which reflected America's rise as a world power. The fair sprawled across 600 acres and 2.5 miles of waterfront. The Avenue of Palms was lined with magnificent new buildings filled with extravagant exhibits. At night, the sky was illuminated with brilliant colored lights. Only 9 years earlier, a catastrophic earthquake had devastated the area. Now San Francisco was ready to welcome the world. From February to December, over 18 million visitors were amazed by what they saw. Among the famous visitors were movie stars Buffalo Bill Cody, Charlie Chaplin, Teddy Roosevelt, and Teddy's cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Attendees could watch Ford making automobiles and the Carnation Company canning condensed milk. Fireworks displays were held 3 times a week, and the Marine Band gave daily concerts. Admiral Perry's Eskimo dogs were a popular attraction, and a trainer shared a frightful performance at the alligator farm, where 4,500 alligators and crocodiles were on display. There was a new marvel around every corner. North Dakota was not left out. On this date in 1915, it was announced that the formal dedication of the North Dakota building would be held on March 16th. The State Commission would be met at the main gate by the Exposition President. From there, a procession accompanied by a military band would march to the state's building. North Dakotans planning to be at the fair were encouraged to attend the dedication. Governor Hanna was to visit on May 21st, which was designated as North Dakota Day. Among the sites at the North Dakota building were agricultural products, an exhibit by the North Dakota Agricultural College, and ceramics created from North Dakota clay. North Dakota horses, cattle, and sheep were part of the major livestock exhibit. North Dakota was one of 26 states that participated. 24 foreign nations were also represented. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We are made in the image of God, and how we love each other, as long as it honors God, who am I to say? Love is love is love is love.
Many worshipers at the United Methodist Church identify as LGBTQ. Now the church faces a decision on gay clergy and same-sex marriage. We question Methodist Bishop Kenneth Carter on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, Prairie Public's Bill Thomas will join us with some winning poetry from this year's Poetry Out Loud event in Bismarck. And we'll talk about Frank's Extra Mile, a new book honoring North Dakota banker Frank Larson. Patrick McCloskey and Jerry Anderson will join us to talk about the book they created. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.